Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We start with a new commitment from the WKAR news team. Here in Michigan, we boast about our forests, our waterways, our history of technology and innovation, and our bounce back from the Great Recession. But education is a much different story. Did you know 56% of Michigan's third graders cannot read proficiently? Also, black and white fourth graders in Michigan rank near the bottom of 50 states for reading. Right now, WKAR is digging deeper into education in Michigan, searching for solutions, giving parents, students, and educators a voice, and holding lawmakers and leaders accountable. WKAR reporter Kevin Lavery will be the reporter leading this effort, and he joins me in studio now. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, Reg. Great to be here.
Your reports start on Tuesdays. How will you start our new initiative?
Well, I'll begin by talking about this year's release of an annual statewide report. Every year, the Michigan League for Public Policy publishes what's called the Kids Count Data Book. It's a series of benchmarks that focuses on children's well-being, and there's something to the tune of 2.2 million children in the state of Michigan. Some of these benchmarks are health and safety, economic security, family life, but education is one of those as well. Now, this year's book will not be released until next Tuesday, so I'm not going to give away the store right now. But it is safe to say that given past year's trends, we're not making any real gains in education. Those trends have been very troubling, especially with regards to third grade literacy.
A lot of times the Kids Count book comes out, the media skims over it, and we forget about it for another year. So how will your reports be different?
Well, I really see this report as being a real guidebook for me this year. There's a lot of data that breaks down the problems to the individual county level, and it takes a close look at what's going on in those places, the socioeconomic factors that are driving why children are succeeding or not. We know that poverty is a huge indicator of a child's success in school and really for the rest of their lives. Not only will I be using the Kids Count data book, but just this past week, the NEEP report came out. Now, NEEP is education jargon for the National Assessment for Educational Progress. The Kids Count book ranks kids county by county in Michigan, how they're doing. The NEEP report measures Michigan against the rest of the country. And I can tell you again, the numbers are not good, even for the NEEP report.
I understand you're also looking at the third grade reading law. Explain what that law is and how you will cover it.
Sure. 2 years ago, the Michigan legislature passed a law that said any third grade student who does not score proficiently in the English language arts section of the MSTEP, that's our standardized test, will be required to repeat the third grade. Now, that does not actually take effect until the 2019 school year in terms of the kids being retained. But educators are looking very closely and will be looking very closely at the scores this year. The MSTEP testing begins at the end of this month and runs into the first couple of weeks of May. So now the law is requiring districts to provide extra support to K through 3 teachers when they're helping out their students. Also, in addition to things like parent-teacher conferences, if a child is falling behind in reading, parents will be notified right then and there, and school districts are preparing a reading-at-home plan for parents to take on with their kids. So it's safe to say that Michigan is trying to turn the ship around. The state wants to be a top 10 education state in 10 years, attract new talent for a new economy that's very largely information-based, et cetera. But the statistics are showing that we have a very long way to go.
And again, this is a year-long effort, and I'm glad that you are leading our effort in reporting this, Kevin.
Thank you, Reginald. I'm looking forward to it as well.
And again, listen for Kevin Lavery's reports every Tuesday on Morning Edition between 5 and 9 a.m. on 90.5 FM WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Our commitment to education at WKAR goes beyond just reporting. Last year, we gifted every kindergartner in the Lansing School District with PBS Kids Playtime Pads. WKAR-TV is the home of Curious Crew, where Michigan children investigate the principles of science, technology, engineering, and math. It's a show made here at Michigan State University that is distributed to PBS stations across the country. And this year, WKAR added Robin Pizzo as our Director of Education, and she joins me in studio now. Welcome, Robin.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. So first, a little bit about your background. You spent years in education systems.
I did. I was a Lansing School District teacher for over 10 years. I also taught at the post-secondary level at Davenport University and was an administrator at Lansing Community College, working with families and children to help support them get through their educational programs.
What is your role here at WKAR?
So my role is Director of Education, and the goal of that role and my major responsibilities really is about pushing education throughout the community and really focusing on expanding our educational framework here. So we do that in several ways. I make sure that we're supporting parents and children and the education community with all of our resources, being able to access those resources and learning tools, as well as provide workshops, and then also convening partnerships among the education community to move children and families forward when it comes to their educational goals.
So I understand we do have some community events coming up. So what are some of those?
My goal is to be everywhere that we can be with WKAR. That includes upcoming science festival through Michigan State University. And then we also will be at the Lansing Baby Fair at the Lansing Center on April 22nd in the Little Learners Corner for our early learners and our infant to age 8 families. And then we will also be speaking and presenting at the Teen Parent Summit located at LCC West Campus. That's on the 19th, and we'll be at the Capitol for the April Earth Day, presenting all things WKAR PBS and nature to family and children that come and participate.
And we are talking with Robin Pizzo, our Director of Education here at WKAR. What is the importance of having a station like WKAR here in East Lansing so involved in education?
You know, I think the most important thing about WKAR is we are the number one trusted brand for educational content. Our community looks to WKAR for quality programming that really helps to dive deep into issues surrounding our community and our state, as well as in support of our families. And so, you know, that trust that our community has means that we have an extensive reach. We are in over 90% of all households. And so as families turn to us and look to us for resources and supports, we really want to be a partner and an advocate for what they need to continue to help support their children achieve at the highest level that they can achieve.
What drove you to be in this education business?
I have always loved school. I've always loved school. And I used to tell my students that all the time, is that I've had a joy and a love affair with learning since I could first begin to learn. I've loved reading and just being able to communicate and connect with people that are new and diverse and varied has always been a passion of mine. And so education just wooed me. I came here in law school at Michigan State and I started substitute teaching and fell in love with learning all over again and being able to see young people just grow and expand and fall in love with learning also.
Well, thank you for joining us, Robin Pizzo, Director of Education at WKAR, and welcome aboard.
Thank you.
This is Current State from WKAR. And we are not finished talking about education. The Michigan State University Board of Trustees meeting Friday saw an hour of public comment, with protesters loudly and repeatedly criticizing the board and interim president, John Engler. WKAR's Scott Pohl was there.
Your time is up. Thank you very much.
There was a lot of that at the trustees' meeting, with members of the group Reclaim MSU holding up phones with photos of survivors of Larry Nassar's abuse because signs weren't permitted at the meeting. Speakers like Lisa Lorenz, mother of survivor Kaylee Lorenz, singled out Engler and board chairman Brian Breslin for rebuke.
You know, I heard you praise Luanna Simon, and 2 days later you asked for a resignation. And then today it's all about Engler, and you wonder why we're upset? If you would say, we're sorry, Spartans really will do better, you wouldn't have all of this.
Reclaim MSU put out a 19-page plan to create a new university board for the presidential search that would include faculty, students, and staff. None of the trustees nor President Engler spoke with reporters after the meeting. Scott Pohl, WKAR News.
Up next on Current State.
That's 1.3 tons of food wasted or lost every single year.
Ideas to keep billions of dollars of good food from ending up in a landfill. Plus, local doctors talk about a new vaccine for the shingles.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot.
And you may have heard Hamilton will play the Wharton. Find out what else is coming. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
I got a lot of brains but no polish. I got a holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough, a shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal, my power of speech, unimpeachable. Only
food is the language everyone speaks, but do we truly understand it?
Between the conversations over organic food and GMOs, different diets taking the world by storm, and how what we eat actually impacts our environment,
there's no shortage of things to learn about. Hi, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is Serving Up Science. Welcome to Serving Up Science, this series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and planet. I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And I'm Karel Vega.
And today's episode is all about what we eat, or really what we're not eating. Karel, what did you have for dinner last night?
I had a delicious cheeseburger, or bacon burger.
Had
bacon on it.
How was it?
It was delicious. I really, really liked it.
And did you finish the whole thing?
I did not. I actually got a little full and had half of it left. I rolled it up in the wrapper and I threw it out.
Ooh, see, that's a problem. You contributed to food waste. And that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Let's do it. How much food are we wasting?
So around the world, that's 1.3 tons of food wasted or lost every single year, or a third of all food made for human consumption. So as a percentage, do you know what that might be per year?
Oof, what?
40%, Karel. 40% of the food we're growing gets wasted.
That is incredible. You're telling me nearly half of the food that is produced in the country, we just throw it in the garbage?
It's true. And you know what? It's not just food. It's money. So all of that food, it gets grown, processed, transported. We dispose of it. It comes into a lot of money. It's estimated to cost $218 billion of food every single year just in the U.S., or $1,800 average for each household of four.
Oof, a lot of food and a lot of money.
And that's not where we stop either. At a time when we should be doing all of these different efforts to save water and to save energy, food waste wastes both of those too. So it takes a lot of water to grow all of that food we're wasting. It actually also takes a lot of fertilizer and a lot of energy. So conservatively, it's estimated that we waste at least 2% of the entire energy budget of the U.S. every single year to the food that we throw away. Ugh.
Okay, so food waste is bad. I get it. We're losing food, money, water, and energy.
And that's not all. We are contributing to greenhouse gas emissions with all the stuff we throw away.
What do you mean?
So as I said, you know, we're trying to conserve energy, conserve water, but we're also trying to emit fewer carbon emissions. And instead of doing that, food waste generates methane, which is a greenhouse gas, and that contributes to climate change. So because of all of this wasted food, landfills are the third largest source of methane in the U.S. And we're also wasting a lot of space, and it's all making a really big mess. So food waste is the single largest component of municipal landfills in America. It's over a quarter, 28% of the world's agricultural area is used to produce food we don't even eat. And here's the whopper of it all. If food waste was its own country, it would rank number 3 in CO2 emissions behind the U.S. and China.
Okay, I get it. Food waste is a problem. Now I feel guilty about throwing away half that burger.
Don't feel bad, Carell. It's just a little food for thought about what we're all buying and what we're throwing away.
Now that I've heard all the bad, what are we doing around the country and around the world to fix food waste?
We are doing a lot. I mean, there's a program right here in Lansing called Scraps to Soil where they take food waste and they bring it over to Hammond Farms and it gets composted and turned into great soil. There are things that schools are doing all around the country to waste less food. Even Michigan State University has a great program to reduce their food print on the environment. So I think all of us can contribute in our own ways. But from a personal perspective, when I go to the supermarket, I try to think a little more carefully about what I'm going to be using that week and what might end up sitting in the back of my fridge for a few months till I remember that I bought it.
Yeah, I think we've all had those moments where we open the fridge and it's full, but we don't have anything to eat. And I think that is a very easy way to start chipping away at the issue.
We can't recover all the food that we're wasting, and we can't even really come close. But we can do better at distributing food so more people who need it have enough to eat and we're wasting less. We can invest in better farming practices. We can improve the research on food waste. And we can help educate consumers about the choices that are going to be saving them money.
If you have something you want to add to the conversation about food waste, an observation, or maybe a tip on how to reduce food waste, let us know by commenting on the Serving Up Science page on WKAR.org. You've been listening to Serving Up Science, the series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and our planet. Next week on Serving Up Science, we'll talk about where Americans are turning for information on what to eat. I'm Carell Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And you're listening to Current State on WKAR.
Thanks, Carell and Cheryl. And every weekend here on Current State, you can listen for Serving Up Science. And you can hear the newest episodes on All Things Considered, Wednesday afternoons between 4 and 7 on 90.5 FM WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Many people who have experienced shingles say it's the greatest pain they've ever endured. Since it was licensed in 2006, the vaccine Zostavax has been recommended to older Americans to prevent shingles. Late last year, doctors began to recommend a new vaccine they think will be more effective than Zostavax. WKAR's Scott Pohl talks with Dr. Peter Gulick of the MSU College of Osteopathic Medicine about shingles and that new vaccine, Shingrix.
Shingles occurs in about a million cases per year, and then there's various ways of looking at it. It usually occurs more in the elderly population. So as you get beyond age 50, then the incidence goes up. So perhaps 5 per 1,000 cases when you're greater than age 50. Then when you go beyond the age of, say, 60 to 70, it becomes 11 cases per 1,000. But the important thing to remember is it can occur in anyone. So I've seen cases in young individuals. I've seen cases more often in patients that are considered immunocompromised, where they may be on steroids, they may be getting chemotherapy, they may be getting treatment for their inflammatory conditions like arthritis, et cetera.
The old shingles vaccine is called Zostavax. Tell me what you know about how effective that proved to be over the course of time.
Okay, so Zostavax is a live virus. So what they've done with that is they've taken the varicella-zoster vaccine or varicella-zoster virus and inactivated it so it's not necessarily infectious, but it's still live. And so what it does is it can stimulate your immune system a little more effectively than if the virus wasn't alive. And so some of the statistics on how effective it is, again, depends on your age. So the younger you are, the more you tend to have a healthy immune system, so you react a little better. So in the live varicella zoster vaccine, approximately 70% of individuals age 50 to 59 will respond to it. When you get beyond age 60, now the effectiveness drops to about 64%. And then when you're beyond the age of 70, now it drops to about 38%. The important thing to remember is that this vaccine may not last forever, like a lot of people think. And so they've done studies and they've noticed that after about 6 years post-vaccination, less than 35% of individuals still have an effective immunity to this.
The new vaccine is called Shingrix. What do we know about how that is supposedly an improvement over Zostavax?
Shingrix is a recombinant adjuvant vaccine. So what that means, very simplistically, is it's not a live virus anymore. What they've done is they've taken a part of the virus and they've attached onto it another substance which can very much stimulate the immune system, and it's called an adjuvant. And it can be of different products, but basically the mechanism is that this adjuvant stimulates the immune system that then gets starts to recognize the part of the zoster virus, so that then it becomes an effective vaccine. But the recombinant vaccine is much, much more effective as far as stimulating the immune system than the live virus. What I'd like to do is give you a comparison of the effectiveness of the Shingrix to as far as your immune response compared to the live virus. So, for instance, with the Shingrix, in individuals that are 50 to 59 years of age, it's 96.6% effective. When you're going from age 60 to 69, it becomes 97% effective. And then even when you're age over 70, it's still 91.3% effective. So it's much, much more effective as far as stimulating your immune system than the live vaccine.
I seem to recall that we used to recommend that people get the Zostavax vaccination at the age of 60. Are you saying that we're starting to recommend Shingrix for people at the age of 50?
That is correct. So right now, the ACIP, which is the governing body for vaccinations, and it's national group that gives advice on different vaccines and how to vaccinate and when to vaccinate, but their recommendation was, yes, greater than age 50.
We're talking about the new shingles vaccine, Shingrix, with Dr. Peter Gulick of the MSU College of Osteopathic Medicine. What if you got the Zostavax vaccine just even in the last year or two? Are you recommending that people get Shingrix on top of that?
Yes, I am, because, again, there's no harm to doing that. Plus, you're getting a more effective vaccine that's going to be much more effective in stimulating your immune system. And, again, where the real advantage of the vaccine is, again, to prevent you from getting shingles, because I can't stress enough how painful this condition really is. But even more so, it will be effective in preventing the post-herpetic neuralgia as well, which is one condition that I've taken care of many patients with and is extremely debilitating as far as the pain that it can cause.
Are there any risks or side effects that we know of yet associated with Shingrix?
Yes, there are. Now, because it is such an effective vaccine for stimulating the immune system, it can cause some adverse effects, and they have described this. And so some of the adverse effects are in about 16.5% of individuals, they have reported some type of adverse effect. And the most common ones are either local pain and redness at the site of vaccine, which is seen in about 10% of cases. And then there's a more systemic type of condition where you may get a little bit of muscle ache, fatigue, and even headache, almost like getting the flu, but not nearly as bad as the flu, but symptoms very similar. And that occurs again in about 10%. Just a couple more points about the Shingrix vaccine. If you've had a outbreak of shingles, then you are still a candidate to get the vaccine, usually within several months to a year after the infection is completed. And it still has been found to be effective in preventing further outbreaks. The other thing is, in patients that have chronic diseases, say diabetes or rheumatoid arthritis or chronic renal disease, they are also candidates for this vaccine, and I highly recommend they get it because those are the individuals that tend to have more of a risk of getting a reactivation of the varicella zoster virus. And even if you're on low-dose immunosuppressives, such as prednisone, as long as you're on doses that are lower than usually 20 milligrams, you would still be a candidate for this vaccine. So these are some of the other individuals that I think should definitely consider getting this vaccine.
We've been talking about the new shingles vaccine, Shingrix, with Dr. Peter Gulick of the MSU College of Osteopathic Medicine. Dr. Gulick, thank you.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. The Michigan State University Science Festival continues for another week. There are hundreds of interactive activities to teach you and your family about the sciences, as well as technology and math. Last week, submarine pilot and National Geographic explorer Erica Bergman gave a speech at the Kellogg Center about exploring the oceans. Before her speech, I spoke with Bergman about her adventures, the oceans, and the questions she receives from the public.
It's really cold and dark and quiet. But when you turn the lights on, there's this astounding amount of life outside the window. You're going to have interactions with things you couldn't even dream of. They're straight out of a sci-fi film, and they're planet Earth's most vibrant and prolific creatures. 90% of the living space on planet Earth is underwater, and very few of us actually get to go down and see that. So it's this mind-altering journey to the bottom of the ocean. Typically, our dives are down a few thousand meters. The deepest point in the ocean is 10,000 meters, and only 3 people have ever been there. More people have been to space than have been to the bottom of the ocean.
What interested you in this career?
I like engines and motors and electronics and things that whir and buzz and stuff like that. So I always worked on engines, and I studied oceanography at the University of Washington in Seattle, but I always worked on boats. And then I found a boat that could go deep under the ocean, and I was instantly addicted. Had to be a submarine pilot. Had to do it.
What is the message you're trying to convey to everyone in helping them care about our oceans and our waters?
I think the message is self-evident when you go snorkeling or go swimming or hear some stories from submarines. And that is that the surface of the ocean is not a firm, opaque, impossible, impenetrable layer. It's just a barrier between two very deeply connected worlds. And it's our privilege and our duty to cross that boundary and understand what's down there, because we depend on it way more than we think we do. We don't even know how deeply we depend on it. But what we do know is that life on planet Earth would not exist without what happens in the ocean.
When people ask you questions about the ocean, is there a difference between what kids ask you about and what adults ask you about? And
yeah.
What are they concerned about?
Kids ask the best questions. Generally, adults want to know what they can do to make the planet a better place, which is extremely positive. And it's really easy to answer, too. Stop using single-use plastics and reuse your clothing for long periods of time. Those are two really simple things. What kids ask are, what is the shark thinking about when he sees you? Which is a question that I never would have even asked myself. And then I put myself in that shark's shoes, flippers, fins, and think about what that shark is thinking when it sees this teeny tiny little glass bubble with goofy hairless humans staring right back at it. It's like the shark gets to go to the aquarium and look at us. Kids have these fantastic questions, and they're really, really exciting to talk to.
What's your biggest concern about our oceans and that we could see disappear before we even could really study them well?
Well, there's definitely a well-known issue with lionfish, invasive lionfish in the Caribbean. We found a lionfish down at 1,500 feet once, and we were with a researcher that brought it up, sliced open its belly, and inside were six different species of fish, two of which were completely unknown to science. So we're having invasive species that are demolishing populations of fish that we haven't even had a chance to discover. Imagine how many things are down there to find. Invasive species is a big thing, and just the way that we treat fish in the ocean. You know, if we start changing the trophic cycle, the who eats what in the ocean, we're gonna affect very great change on our own lives down the road.
What is the importance of having a festival like the MSU Science Festival?
Opportunities to see what other people are working on and have genuine, organic conversations with passionate people is what really changes the lives of especially our next generation explorers. And that one-on-one conversation that a big brother, big sister type figure might have on a student could change their life for the positive in a very big way. And you just never know when that interaction is going to happen. It's probably happening 1,000 times a day at a festival like this. And it's very hard to track that impact, but it's definitely evident. And it will be even more evident in 10 years when these kids grow up and do really positive things for our planet.
Did you have a moment or at a place like the festival where it really helped push you ahead? You already had the interest, but it really pushed your interest ahead?
Yeah, I think it was a biology teacher, you know, freshman year of high school, who took a vested interest in making everything hands-on and having those one-on-one conversations and just also being goofy, you know, being really a kid about science. And the trick to making science exciting and actionable is by just having fun with it. I mean, it is, at its essence, a whole bunch of little kids with toys, and they're going to go explore the world like a magnifying glass. And our magnifying glass now is just a really big, expensive scanning electron microscope. But there's the joy of childhood in science, and I think that's what needs to be shared.
Well, thank you, Erica. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the Wharton Center unveils its next season of concerts, lectures, and, of course, national tours of Broadway musicals. Find out when the supersized residency of the smash hit Hamilton comes to East Lansing. Also, you will hear from the creators of a new documentary about the Michigan State University team that broke barriers. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. You're listening to Current State from WKAR. Earlier this week, the Wharton Center in East Lansing unveiled their 2018-2019 season to the general public. Our own fine arts expert, Jamie Paisley, has a rundown of some of the performances for us on Current State, starting with the already announced arrival of the mega-hit musical, Hamilton.
I am not throwing away my shot. I I am not throwing away my shot.
The majority of the MSU FCU Broadway series at Borden Center is 6 days of a residency of a musical, but for Hamilton, it's quite a bit longer.
That's correct. Most of our Broadway shows are a Broadway week, which is 6 days, 8 performances. For Hamilton, we have 3 times as many, starting in late May and going into June. The way this works is you have top priority if you're a renewing subscriber from last year. So we're encouraging all of last year's subscribers to renew their subscription as quickly and early as possible into the 18-19 season. Then if you are a new subscriber, you become the next priority on the list. And then after that, tickets will become available to the general public. However, the producers do set the prices, and there'll be one set of prices for our subscribers, one set of prices for the general public. It's all subject to availability.
While Hamilton ends the Wharton Center's Broadway season from May 14th through June 2nd of 2019, the Wharton Center's Director of Marketing and Communications, Diane Wilcox, tells me that the season begins with a 1-2 punch of Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yes, it does, which is a whole lot of fun. First, we start with Andrew Lloyd Webber light, as it were, with School of Rock, which is, of course, based on the Jack Black movie.
Now repeat after me, I pledge allegiance to the band.
I pledge allegiance to the
band. When you see that kid pick up the bass, he's playing the bass. The guy's playing the guitar, they're playing the drums. It's absolutely an amazing show. It's so much fun, it's delightful. And we follow that hard on the heels with Love Never Dies. This is the sequel to The Phantom of the Opera. 10 years later, takes place actually in Coney Island, and the Phantom cannot live without Christine, and so he has followed her to the United States.
Little we deserve.
In early December this year, a great tradition hits Wharton Center with Fiddler on the Roof, and another side of Russian family ties in January of 2019 with the stage adaptation of the film Anastasia by Flaherty and Aarons of Once on This Island and Ragtime fame. But in March of 2019, the heat is on in East Lansing by way of Saigon, Miss Saigon.
What's wonderful about this is they have done something with the script, and I'm not sure exactly what, but it's been tightened up. The narrative is very, very clear. The plot, you know, you really understand what's going on in the last days of the Vietnam War. Absolutely gorgeous, absolutely beautiful, exciting, and amazing special effects. You will see a helicopter.
And of course, as mentioned before, on the heels of Miss Saigon, Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton closes the Wharton Center's Broadway tours with a 3-week residency.
For the Wharton Center, the classical music events are getting off with a really nice 1-2 punch in October, starting with somebody that made headlines when she said she was stepping down from her singing roles at the Metropolitan Opera, and finishing out with Der Rosenkavalier, but Renee Fleming is coming.
That's right. And just that announcement kind of inspired us that maybe we should present Renee Fleming. It's also been a number of years since she's been here, and Miss Fleming is going to open the season. And then the next we have one of my favorite orchestras, the Czech Philharmonic. Which I've just heard in Prague, which is an extraordinary orchestra. It's really involved in doing a lot of CDs, the Tchaikovsky Project, and they're bringing their chief conductor, Annalisa Weilerstein, here to do a concert of Dvorak's music.
The final concert for the classical series, though, is kind of a makeup event from somebody that was scheduled to perform at the Wharton Center but had to bow out at the last minute. And we're certainly glad to have him rescheduled.
Yes, yeah, so are all of us. He's probably one of my favorite concert pianists, Efim Bronfman. I've heard him play in so many different American orchestras these past couple years, and we're really glad to have him wrap up the year.
We're going to pivot now from Wharton Center's executive director, Mike Brand, to Diane Wilcox, director of marketing and communications, because while we leave the classical music realm of the Wharton Center's 2018-19 season and go to the theatrical, there is still a classical music element that shows up.
This year in our Illuminate series, which is really focused on the spoken word, we will be featuring The Other Mozart, which is this amazing one-woman piece. It's about Nannerl Mozart, who is Amadeus' sister, and she very clearly had virtually if the same genius level, if not greater, than her brother. However, upon entering adulthood, her father said, "You are now done, and you need to become a wife and a mother." And this really is the story of Nannerl and Amadeus and their father through their letters. We also have Theater of War will be bringing us Promethea in Prison, which is actually a reading, and we do not know who will be performing because Theater of War works with some very high-level actors and performers. It's notably Promethea, not Prometheus, and it really deals with issues of after Promethea is ensnared, as it were, and jailed, and what that is like in dealing with women in prison today. Those are the issues, and there'll be a wonderful panel discussion as part of the performance.
For more information about the complete schedule of the Wharton Center's just-announced 2018-19 season of performances, featuring Renee Fleming, Elisa Weilerstein, Yefim Bronfman, and the Illuminate series of plays, including The Other Mozart and more, visit whartoncenter.com. For WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. Gene Washington is one of MSU's greatest football heroes. He was one of the African-American players recruited by Coach Duffy Doherty out of the Deep South in the 1960s, integrating college football and winning national championships. Washington's daughter, Maya, has made a documentary film about her father, his teammates, and what their history means to modern-day players. It's called Through the Banks of the Red Cedar. WKAR's Scott Pohl talked with the Washingtons about the project 3 years ago. Now it's finished, and it's debuting this weekend at the Freep Film Festival in Detroit. Scott and Maya recently talked again for an update on the documentary.
The civil rights movement was not just about marches and sit-ins and boycotts and protests. It was also about confronting segregation in different spaces. And the Michigan State teams of the 1960s, they confronted segregation on the field physically. They challenged the color line in numerous ways.
So tell me about these last 3 years. What has it taken to finish up this film?
This past 3 years have been grueling and exciting and filled with twists and turns. I knew going into this that I was a tough cookie, but on the other side of the past 3 years, I really had an opportunity to see what I was made of and how deeply I believed in this film and the need for the stories of my father and his teammates to be told in this way. And the most humbling experience of the past 3.5 years is that, you know, I funded this literally out of my pocket. We got support from foundations who believed in the story, and myself as a filmmaker who gave us grants and other things. But the real power came from the 350 individuals who rallied to support this film, who believed in the importance of telling positive stories about race and sports today. And that is what kept me going.
You talked with current players, but that was 3 years ago. So I'm wondering if you needed to continue to talk with current players, or, you know, has your movie changed because of the time that has passed?
Well, we decided to kind of allow it to be a film that happened in 2013, 2014, 2015, rather than try to go back and kind of manipulate time and space. You know, many of the guys we interviewed at the time are now in the NFL, have had really interesting careers and have moved on with their lives. They've graduated from Michigan State, and some of them even have children at this point. But we decided to really keep it set in 2013-2014 season and focus on the father-daughter relationship that happens in the present that allows us to get to know what's happening in modern day college football culture. And so you'll see people like Max Bulla and Benny Fowler, Kaj Reynolds, talking about sort of their experience and their relationship to my dad's team at the time that their team is on the way to the Rose Bowl. So it's still relevant and still fits nicely and neatly in our story, even though, you know, most of these young people in the film have moved on to sort of the next step. Unfortunately, we've lost a few of my dad's teammates in the time that I've been interviewing people and finally finished the film. So it was really important to just stick with what we had because it was so special and to just have faith that the story that we told in that time and space would be relevant and special. And I think it is.
When I met with you and your dad 3 years ago, your dad spoke warmly of Duffy Doherty. Let's listen.
Duffy, the time that he spent down south recruiting black athletes and also doing coaching clinics in the Texas area for black coaches, high school coaches. He was the only major college coach that was doing that.
Your dad's respect and affection for Duffy Doherty is clear. Folks hearing you and me talk right now will want to know how your dad is doing these days. How's your dad doing?
My dad's doing great. I mean, his health is really good. And we've really enjoyed spending time together through this process of making the film. And now, hopefully, as we start screening the film and we've had opportunities to go into educational communities and colleges and talk about his story. And, you know, he's doing great and he's been very fortunate health-wise that a lot of the challenges that men in their 70s and also former athletes are going through, some of his peers are going through, he's mindful of those things being of concern, but his mantra is every day is a gift.
Through the Banks of the Red Cedar will screen twice in Metro Detroit this weekend at the Freep Film Festival. But Maya Washington, this is an East Lansing story. When are we going to see this film in East Lansing?
When East Lansing invites me. Whenever Michigan State, whenever the Lansing community wants us to come, the biggest challenge for us has been finances. And so the Freep Festival has been following us and staying in touch with us and waiting to see, you know, what the film would look like so that we could submit it for consideration. And so they got to me first. I'm so grateful, you know, to have that opportunity. But of course, it's an East Lansing story, and it's very much a Michigan State film. And we produced it independently, independent of any, you know, Michigan State funds or anything like that. But it's the Spartan community that funded this project, alumni who really were the key to sort of getting us off the ground and keeping us alive and keeping us standing. So of course, we hope to get to East Lansing when, you know, we can afford to.
Well, here we are, Maya Washington, putting the word out there. East Lansing folks involved in bringing movies to the city. You've got to bring this movie to East Lansing through the Banks of the Red Cedar. Until that happens, it will screen at the Freep Film Festival on Saturday at 1:30 at the Detroit Institute of Arts and on Sunday at 1 at Imagine Royal Oak. We've been talking with the film's maker, Maya Washington, whose father, Gene Washington, was part of the national championship football team at MSU back in the 60s. Maya, great talking with you again. Thanks.
Thank you.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
That's all for this edition of Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. For the entire WKAR news team, we'll connect with you next weekend. And in honor of Motown's incorporation this week, 59 years ago, we leave you with a little Stevie Wonder.